It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
Okay, so this is a Dearly Departed first. We are actually recording video as we do this. So those of you listening to the audio only, this should be available on YouTube, and we'll post links and stuff eventually. But we are doing a video now, in part because we're just being responsible adults and staying socially distanced from each other and recording this remotely from each other's apartments. So here we are. It's Dearly Departed. I'm Mike Dorsey.
I'm Scott Michaels.
And we are going to do Different Strokes. Personally, my first favorite sitcom when I was growing up was Different Strokes. So this will be a good one. And just lots of tragedy with this show, unfortunately.
Yeah, lots of mileage for Dearly Departed, folks. how old were you when this show started?
This show started, I think it was 4 months old in 78. And and then I grew up with it. Like, sorry, Scott.
Wow.
and then it ran from 78 to 86. The last season, I think, was it switched networks. So lots of tragedy, unfortunately. But before we get into that, why don't we do deaths of the week, which really is deaths of the month at this point.
News of the week.
I think number one on the list, and you probably would agree, would have to be Kenny Rogers.
Oh, yeah, I like Kenny a lot. I did, yeah.
And you used to.
He was.
you used to be a country music DJ.
Right? I was. Yeah, I was. WMLM, the middle of Lower Michigan, and they used to get. I did the nighttime shift. I was like, I don't know, it was 7 to 11 or something like that, and I had to shut it down for the night. I mean, literally, like throwing switches in the tower.
Really?
The middle of nowhere. St. Louis, Michigan, the middle of the mitten. But and they used to get annoyed with me because I always played like the same five songs every night. I mean, I had a whole night of programming, but I would always play the same five songs, and one of them was a Kenny Rogers song. And they were just like, "You can't play those every night, Scott. You can't." I didn't last long.
Well, he was a country music legend. He sold over 100 million albums in his life, in his career. He's Country Music Hall of Fame, The Gambler, Lucille. Just dropped in to see what condition my condition is in. Just hit after hit. I think he had like 120 hit singles. I mean, just pretty.
Country artists do, you know. And I mean, like, you look at Dolly, and Dolly's released like 75 albums or something like that. You know, they churn them out. They really do. And I'm not being dismissive. Mm-hmm. It's just like country artists, man. They pump out the recordings. They really do.
It's like they go into a studio and knock out an album in like 2 nights. Almost,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But he did have a slew of hits. Love Will Turn You Around was my favorite of his. I think he was one of the first country artists to really cross over. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Lynn Anderson did Happiest. I'm not sure. I mean, there were a lot of so and so's, but maybe even Dolly. Maybe even Dolly was preceded him as far as being the big crossover. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure now, but Kenny certainly touched on a lot of different, and as an actor too, you know, he did the Gambler movie. Mm-hmm. And a couple of others.
Yep. He died on March 20th at the age of 81 from natural causes. And he definitely knew when to fold him.
Ooh.
I think next, James Lipton, most famous for Inside the Actor's Studio, but an actor himself. Mm-hmm. Also, he died on the 2nd of March at 93 from bladder cancer. And did you see this story where he disagrees that this is what you would call him, but he was basically like a pimp in France after World War II? Do you see this?
No.
He said a pimp is more like someone who actually pimps the girls out. He said the girls weren't working for me. He said I was working for them. You know, he would go with them and drive them places and stuff. But yeah, he did that after the war. It's kind of crazy. And he talked openly about it late in life, that that's what he did. But you wouldn't, watching that show, you would never guess that that person, the host of Inside
Actors
Studio.
No, I mean, yeah.
You know?
Colorful past.
Mm-hmm. Max von Sydow, who is most famous, Swedish actor, most famous for the lead in Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal. He plays chess with death. And then he was also Christ in The Greatest Story Ever Told. And probably most famous to American audiences as the priest in The Exorcist.
Right. Yeah, he was. It's funny. He looked older when they made The Exorcist than he did when he died. I mean, he was. but yeah, an iconic American film. When I lived in England, you couldn't the Exorcist and Clockwork Orange were banned. You know, you could not. They weren't allowed to release them.
Oh, really?
They never showed them on the screens. And it wasn't until probably 1998 or 99 that they lifted the ban on those movies.
Wow.
But it didn't exist in England. You heard about it, but they just, you know, it was black market. It was, you know, bootleg, et cetera. But those movies were never released.
Well, that makes me want to jump ahead because, oh, well, first of all, Max passed away on March 8th at the age of 90. No cause was listed, but obviously he was 90. But speaking of things that were banned in England, Mark Blum, sorry if I'm getting that wrong, he was a star of Desperately Seeking Susan, but he also had a role in Crocodile Dundee as the editor of Sue, the lead female role in that movie. He plays her editor and boyfriend, and he's this total snob, and he's a jerk to, he's kind of a villain really in the movie. He's a real jerk to Crocodile Dundee and kind of talks down to him as this simpleton. I found out that there were 24 seconds had to be shaved off of Crocodile Dundee for the UK release because they wouldn't show drug use in order to get the rating that they wanted. And there's a scene where a guy snorts cocaine at a party and there's a whole gag around it. And it wasn't until like 10 years later that they put it back in for people in the UK.
It's fascinating because it's for a country that is so progressive in a lot of ways, that seems so archaic. You know, something that's interesting, did you know, and you probably do know this, but I didn't until recently, when you do a documentary, you're allowed to say the word fuck, but you can't use it in the way that you're having sex.
I never heard that before.
What brought this up was I was watching a documentary about the Cowsills, which was a band, you know, the Partridge Family is sort of based on the Cowsills in the 70s. And the young girl who was in the band claimed she was molested by her father. And she could say, well, you know, this fucking idiot or something like that. But when he said, and then he fucked me, that had to be beeped out.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, so it was using it as a verb. You couldn't.
Huh.
But as a exclamation, you could. I don't know if that's a law straight out with censors, but that's
really
the
wild
way it was in this particular doc.
Wow. Well, Mark passed away on March 25th. He was 69. And unfortunately, he's going to be our first COVID-19 death on our show. Later years, he was more recently in Mozart in the Jungle series. And so rest in peace, Mark.
Yeah.
Here's another one. Adam Schlesinger, co-founder of the band Fountains of Wayne, a prolific songwriter and music producer, probably most famous for Stacy's Mom song from 2003. He won 3 Emmys, a Grammy. He was also Oscar, Tony, and Golden Globe nominated. A lot of people will probably most know him as the songwriter of That Thing You Do, for the movie That Thing You Do.
Mm-hmm. I saw about 20 of his obituaries, and then that was never mentioned.
Oh, really?
That's interesting. Yeah. I love that. It's one of my favorite movies, mm-hmm. in the song. I love that. But and he's another Corona person.
Yeah, unfortunately, he was 52. He passed away
just
a couple of days ago, April 1st, at the age of 52 from COVID-19.
I just saw that there was somebody posted a Twitter thread of his, and his last tweet was something like, "See you in a couple of days when all this madness stops," and that was that.
Man. Krzysztof Penderecki, a composer whose music is in The Exorcist, again, The Shining. He was David Lynch used it in Wild at Heart. You have a story about him. You heard a song, a piece of his called Auschwitz Oratorium in a music store, you said, in the 80s?
Yeah, I must have been about 16 or 17, but it was a record store called Harmony House. It was where everyone in Detroit, at least from my side of town, got our records, and it was playing there. And it was like the most haunting, most craziest. I think it was before The Shining came out. That was 1980, I think. But yeah, I bought it right away, and it was really something. It's really so sinister and haunting and. It is a fascinating piece of music.
Yeah, he passed away on March 29th at the age of 86, and they just said he'd had a long illness. David Schramm, he was Roy Biggins on Wings, which was another one of my early sitcom favorites. He played the kind of heavyset guy with the mustache. He was kind of a foil for the other characters. He was always kind of scheming, and he was kind of a very self-centered character. He was one of the leads on that. Man, what a great cast that had. They had Thomas Hayden Church and Tony Shalhoub and Tim Daly and Steven Weber all on the same sitcom together. It's one of those, like, star-making shows, you know?
Yeah,
Roy passed away on March 28th at 73, and they didn't give a cause. I don't know.
All these 80s sitcom people.
I know.
That is 80s, right?
Yes. Well, that was 80s, 90s, okay. I think. It was like, man, we're going to get... All the Wings fans are going to come for us, man. No, I think it was like late 80s into the 90s was Wings.
And you know what the rabid bunch those Wings fans are.
I'm going to have to move. They're going to dox me. back to the country world. Joe Diffie, big country star, most famous in the 90s, member of the Grand Ole Opry. The hit that I know, and I'm not really a country fan, but I know John Deere Green. I think everybody has to know that song. That was a major hit. Apparently, he didn't want to record it. And they just kind of did it to, well, let's try it out and see if we like it. And, you know, luckily they did, because it ended up being just a massive hit, one of the biggest country hits of the 90s.
Yeah, boy, he was at the forefront of that new country thing in the 90s. And I was big into that, too. I loved that. I went to see Randy Travis in concert, and I saw, you know, I loved that. I used to go line dancing and all that shit.
Garth Brooks, too, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I liked all that stuff.
Yep, I remember that. I was living in rural Colorado at the time, so I got, whether I wanted to be a part of it or not, I knew all about it.
Yeah.
he died on March 29th at the age of 61, and again, it was coronavirus. And then we also lost fellow Grand Ole Opry member Jan Howard the day before. She was 91. No cause given. So a bad month for country stars, man.
No shit, man.
John Callahan, who is a big soap star, best known for All My Children. He played Edmund Gray on All My Children. He passed away on March 28th at the age of 66 from a stroke. You a big soap star?
You know, I watched All My Kids, but... Yeah. In fact, I do remember... Wait, did you say All My Children?
Yeah.
Was he on All My Children?
It was Edmund Gray on All My Children was what I read, yeah.
Okay. Then I didn't watch it then, but I did watch it. back in the whole, all the Channel 7 soaps, One Life to Live and General Hospital, the whole Luke and Laura thing, that was, yeah, I used to watch all three.
When I was a freshman in college, I remember I had two roommates who, when I switched dorm rooms my freshman year, and the new roommates I moved in with, these guys, it was so funny. They were like super bro-y frat type of guys, but they were like, hey man, every afternoon at like 1:30 or whatever, the TV is ours because we watch Days of Our Lives. It's like, we gotta watch Days, man. And they were like up to date on what everybody was doing, and like all the characters, what everybody was up to. And that's the only time in my life I ever really watched a soap opera on like a regular basis.
Oh, really? See, I watch EastEnders, which is a British one. I watch that religiously. I mean, that is like, I never, unfortunately, they're down to only two episodes a week during this time. Mm-hmm. But fuck, I've been watching that since, I don't know, the 90s. I just love it.
Speaking of soaps, I just watched Tootsie again a couple weeks ago.
And
you know his character's name, right?
No.
Michael Dorsey.
Is that what you were named after?
Nope, I was born...
Were you like...
I was born 4 years before Tootsie came out, so no, I came first. But yeah, and then what happens when he starts dressing as the older woman, he flips it around to Dorothy Michaels from Michael Dorsey.
Okay, and there, so you've got Michael Dorsey and I got the Michaels.
You're right,
so,
there.
Except my first name isn't Dorothy. But, but I've been called Dorothy by people.
Right. And in reviews of Six Degrees of Helter Skelter, they confuse you and I all the time because of our names. Have you ever noticed that?
Oh, do they?
Yeah, they'll say.
No, I think I
read one time that said that I was the host, and another time I read one where it was you made the movie, you were the director, because they just Michael just flips everybody out for some reason. So
yeah, yeah. Oh, I get Michael Scott all the time, all the time. People don't. they always flip them always.
All right. So, and speaking of names, we talked about Crocodile Dundee. Do you know what Crocodile Dundee's full name was?
No.
Michael J. Crocodile Dundee. I am Michael J. Dorsey. I know.
You know, this is freaking me out, Mike. You you and your association with these things is really creeping me out.
We also lost Curly Neal of the Harlem Globetrotters, kind of one of the main guys, I think, from that organization.
Yeah,
he was.
There's Meadowlark and Curly were the two most outstanding. Yeah, for sure. You ever see the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island?
No, but I remember them. I think, weren't they on an episode of Scooby-Doo? I think they were. Right?
Yeah, they were. Yeah. But one of the last live-action Gilligan's Island reunions was the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Legend, man.
Curly died on March 26th, age 77. No cause given. We have I don't want to call it a good death to report, but one that I'm not necessarily sad about. Lonnie Franklin, a.k.a. the Grim Sleeper serial killer, who murdered as many as two dozen people in South L.A. over the course of, you know, a couple of decades, the 80s, mid-80s into the early 2000s. They say he may have killed as many as 25. He was convicted for 10. He passed away on March 26th at the age of 67 on death row. I think he was at San Quentin. They don't know the cause of death yet, or at least I don't know what it is yet. But they said no foul play. Suspected. Yeah. It wasn't suspicious. So may have just been a natural causes thing. He was 67.
Or suicide. I mean, they probably know, but they're just not releasing it. But yeah, not suspicious means he could have topped himself.
Sure, that's true. That's true. Coincidentally, one of the lead detectives on that case, I believe at the time it was solved, was
Michael Dorsey.
No, but Darren Dupree. And Darren Dupree was Greg Kading's partner on the whole Biggie and Tupac investigation. And Darren Dupree is a character on Unsolved. He was played by Bokeem Woodbine, opposite of Josh Duhamel, who played Greg Kading. So the same detective, helped close out that case. There was some criticism over how the LAPD handled that case going back to the 80s, because the neighborhood it was in, a poor, predominantly black neighborhood. He was, mainly killing prostitutes. It's kind of that whole story of, the police don't really care because of who the victims are and where it's happening, and that he basically, he got away with it longer than maybe he would have had he done it somewhere else. I don't know if that's true or not, but...
When you just now talked about the detective from the LAPD, why were the LAPD involved in Tupac's investigation?
So what happened was they originally were investigating Biggie's murder, and they went after a suspect that they thought was responsible for Biggie's murder, or would at least know who was. And they got him into a situation where he was going to have to talk to them or go to prison for something else. And he ended up saying, that Biggie wasn't us, Tupac was. And the two murders turned out to be linked, which people always suspected anyways. So they ended up working both murders, even though they were really just trying to solve the Biggie one. So that's how.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I hope to, once this coronavirus thing is over, to do a Biggie and Tupac show, and we can have Greg Kading on the show to, I'm sure, explain it all. And it's a wild and fascinating story. And Greg Kading himself also has a story of he narrowly avoided being killed by a serial killer when he was a teenager.
Which one?
I can't think of his name, but he was operated down in Orange County. It would have been in, probably the late 70s, early 80s. And I'll let him tell the story eventually, but it's a really wild story. Like, he was in the guy's car, and the guy was going through the motions of, what his MO was, how he would, get a victim and kill them. And Greg wised up to it and got out.
Does that guy have, like, a podcast called The Moth or something like that?
Greg?
Yeah.
No, no.
Literally, somebody sent me a link the other day about a guy who was picked up by a serial killer when he was younger, and it was Gacy.
Oh, wow.
Crap, give me one. I've got to have it like really close. But it was really. Oh God, what's that guy's name? I'll bet. Well, anyway,
I know it wasn't Gacy, but it was a twisted guy though, like Gacy was, though, a really twisted serial killer. But I'll let Greg tell the story when we have him on if he wants to. But yeah, it's a wild one.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Cool. That was. I mean, that's fascinating when people have that kind of. I don't know. Just associations and so many near misses, you know.
Think about how many people came face to face with a serial killer and escaped. Not a lot of people when you think about it. So it's most people don't survive, you know, that kind of encounter. Yeah. So,
or how many serial killers have you walked past in your life and not known?
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Stuart Whitman, Oscar-nominated actor for The Mark and the Comancheros. He was in a bunch of Westerns with John Wayne. He died March 16th, 92, at 92 from skin cancer. And I didn't know how skin cancer can kill you, but apparently it can get into the bloodstream and then you're in trouble. So,
yeah. Terry Melcher died from that.
It happens a lot. Just get that treated, I guess. Keep getting checked.
Yeah. It metastasizes, yeah.
Lyle Wagner from the Carol Burnett Show passed away on March 17th, age 84, also from cancer. You were a Carol Burnett fan?
Yeah, I liked it. I liked it a lot. I thought Lyle Wagner was sort of like a knockoff Rock Hudson, you know what I mean? He sort of had that thing going on. And Carol was really close with Rock Hudson, too. But, you know, you probably know this, but you know Star Wagons is him, right?
W-A-G-G-O-N.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
That's his company.
Well, for people that don't know, Star Wagons it's the company that rents out all the trailers that are used on the sets for the actors and production office people and stuff to have on set. And their logo looks like Star Wars, but it says Star Wagons, yeah. And they're prolific all over L.A. Yeah, I didn't know that. That was Lyle Wagner. Wow. Lorenzo Brino, sorry if I'm getting that wrong. He played one of the young twins on Seventh Heaven. And he passed away in a car accident on March 9th. He was only 21. It was a single car wreck north of Los Angeles. Johnny Yoon, a stand-up comedian. He was the first Asian stand-up comedian to go on The Tonight Show. He was on the show a bunch of times in the 70s and 80s. He passed away on March 8th, 84, from dementia. And Barbara Martin, who was an original member of The Supremes, only for one album, and she passed away on March 4th at 76, no cause given. You're a Supremes fan, right? Motown?
Sure, yeah, yeah. She was involved with, I think, when it was, they were still the Primettes, I think, before they became the Supremes. But
Four of them, right, I guess. And then when she left, they just left it at three. They didn't replace her.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's those girls, the three of them, Florence and Mary and Diana, they were Diane at the time. They were like groupies around the Motown. They would just hang out. They wouldn't even, you know, they weren't even signed for quite a long, like a well over a year. They were just like groupies of Motown until Barry just kind of went, okay, let's see what they can do. And they still recorded a bunch of songs and never got anywhere until Where Did Our Love Go? And that was, they called them the no-hit Supremes because they just went nowhere.
No-hit Supremes. Ouch.
And then it turns out that they were the biggest thing Motown ever did. So,
wow.
But, and poor Barbara just missed out on it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. And speaking of girl singing groups from the mid-1900s, Lynn Evans Mand, who was a singer in the Cordettes, I believe she was the last living member of the Cordettes, I think. They were a big group primarily in the 50s. They had Mr. Sandman and Lollipop. And Mr. Sandman I will always associate with Back to the Future because that's the song that's playing when he first goes back to the 50s. She died on February 6th at the age of 95 from a stroke.
Do you remember they used Lollipop and Stand By Me when they were walking down the railroad tracks?
Oh, okay.
I love that scene, too, when they all pop their...
And they were primarily they did a lot of a cappella or with, you know, minimal backing tracks. It was really the ladies' voices that were doing all the music. And then music one more time. Ellis Marsalis, the jazz pianist giant and father of four extremely successful musicians, including Wynton Marsalis, Branford Marsalis, Jason, and Delfeo. He died on April 1st, 85, from COVID again. So that sucks, man.
Crazy times.
I think Wynton made a nice tribute to him. I'm sure the other sons did too today. And then do we have any more? I'll do one just on a personal note. I did a documentary about 10 years ago called Lost Airmen of Buchenwald. It was about my grandfather. He was shot down over France, and it was this whole ordeal with him getting captured. And before he was captured, he hid out with members of the French underground on this family called the Martins. They had a farm in northern France, and he had on their farm. And after the war, you know, he stayed friends with them. And there were three brothers in the family, and the third and final brother just passed away. I found out yesterday. His name is Fulbert, and he died while taking a nap at 99. And I think that's a pretty good way to go, if you can control it, you know.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to give a shout out to Fulbert Martin. You know, without his family, I wouldn't exist. So, you know, they risked it all. If you got caught hiding someone like my grandpa back then, the Germans would have killed them on sight or sent them to a concentration camp. So that's good. So rest in peace, Fulbert.
That's crazy. Crazy times, man. That's a nuts story, man. That's crazy. It's fascinating.
Did you see there's this great video of this Welsh grandmother kind of giving, you know, it was just a couple days ago it came out, where she's basically wishing people well, and this thing, you know, this situation we're in right now is going to pass. And I think that is one thing to keep in perspective, is we've been through, as weird and crazy as this is, we've dealt with worse. And you know, the older people seem a little bit more even keeled about things, because they've seen some shit, you know what I mean? And they're just kind of like, just, it'll pass and everything will go back to normal.
Yeah,
you know?
But it was always over there.
Right.
That's the thing.
That's
it was always over there. You know, New York, that was over there.
Right.
You know, that, I mean, I'm not saying that what we're doing, what's happening right now, isn't more important or less important than any other time. Mm-hmm. But it was always at a distance.
Yeah, we've always been isolated.
I don't think anyone has ever.
So some miscellaneous stuff. I saw something on your page about Doris Day is having an auction, or they're having an auction for her estate.
Yeah, I don't know how that's going to work out for them. They must be obligated to do it now, because, you know, with everything that's going on, they can't do the viewing. It's not going to be live auction. So
right.
I have a feeling Julian's is going to lose their asses on it. But you know what? They deserve it, because they're fucking assholes. Yeah, I mean, you know, I love Julian's. I do, because I love their auctions, but they jam it to people. I mean, they get it on both ends. They get it from the people who put their stuff out for auction, and outrageous fees. So I, you know, fuck them if they lose money. I feel sorry for Doris Day and her charity, because, you know, obviously the animals were, she lived for animals.
Mm-hmm.
But Julian's, you know, I mean, sorry, karma's a bitch, and not, I don't want to say there's anything good about anything that's going on right now, but sometimes when shitty things happen to people, it's like, there you are.
And you just did something for Karen Carpenter's 70th birthday, right?
Yeah, we did the Carpenter tour, or we call it the Carpentour. and we do it every year on the anniversary and of closest to her death. And then we do it this year, because it was her 70th birthday, we did another one. And it just, you know, to the old Carpenter's haunts, but in the Dearly Departed style.
Right.
So we go to the house where they lived and where she collapsed, and we go to the funeral home, and we go to the, you know, but we go to the nice places as well as.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we do. And we do make a donation in her name to the National Organization for Eating Disorders. So, so, you know, we try to make it, try to balance it out.
Right. Then the news came out that this Jay Sebring documentary is finally going to come out, it sounds like, which his nephew has been making. It seems like he's been making it almost since we put out Helter Skelter over like a decade ago.
Years.
Right?
He's been working on that. Yeah. And he must, I think what might have prompted it this time around is that, I think Tarantino gave him access to the Sebring Salon. So there was some there's some footage of, or some photographs of him with Tarantino in Jay's old salon. So
that's awesome.
I think that might have kicked it in the butt. But he'd never done like a GoFundMe or anything like that. So I'm really looking forward to it because there's a lot of, I know Cammie, his wife, Jay's ex-wife, and probably one of Jay's old proteges. And so it'd be fascinating to get that information about Jay Sebring, who's another Detroit boy.
Right. Yeah. And then you see this story about the guy that stole the Lincoln Navigator from in front of a church here in Los Angeles. This was like last week, it was February 27th, sorry. A guy stole a Lincoln Navigator that was parked in front of a church and then got into a police chase. He ends up wrecking it on the 110 freeway, and there was one fatality, but she was already dead. There was a coffin in the back with a woman in it, woman's body. It was a funeral home, basically a hearse that was a Lincoln Navigator. So the guy stole a Lincoln Navigator with a body in it.
That was wild because that was L.A. We're obsessed with car chases anyway, but
right.
it was an added dimension to that one. And, you know, it's interesting, Mike, I don't know if you caught this, but on the anniversary that happened, or that body being stolen in the Navigator is the anniversary of another body being stolen. And that was the guy by the name of George Tobias, who played the next door neighbor on Bewitched, Abner Kravitz, and his hearse with his body in it was stolen in real life.
Oh,
and,
wow.
It was the anniversary. It was like the weirdest thing.
Wow.
So history repeats itself.
Exactly. And did you have anything else you wanted to dive into before we get into hate mail?
No. I don't want to talk about anything else that's going on right now.
Okay. So hate mail.
Hate mail.
What do you got, Scott?
Well, okay, I have some interesting. First, before we get into the hate, I'm going to tell you a couple of a quick notes that I got from listeners actually. And on our last podcast, I believe we were referring to Chris Farley, and at his funeral, the clown's prayer was read.
Yes.
And somebody actually, a guy by the name of Roger Smith, who is one of our listeners, sent me the actual clown's prayer. And I'll read it real quick.
Great.
It's, Lord, as I stumble through this life, help me to create more laughter than tears, dispense more happiness than gloom, spread more cheer than despair. Never let me become so indifferent that I will fail to see the wonder in the eyes of a child or the twinkle in the eyes of the aged. Never let me forget that my total effort is to cheer people, make them happy, and forget, at least for a moment, all the unpleasant things in their lives. And Lord, in my final moment, may I hear you whisper, when you made my people smile, you made me smile.
Aw, that's nice.
That's quite sweet. So thanks, Roger Smith, for sending that on.
Thank you, Roger.
Also related to the Farley podcast, a guy by the name of James Cox, who actually sent me a little tidbit that we're going to use a little bit later. He listened to the podcast and talked about Tom Arnold as Chris Farley's sponsor. And I said, I made a kind of a crack about, you know, don't have Tom Arnold as your sponsor. And he said, the fact is that Tom was off drugs and alcohol for quite a while, and they were the best of friends, he and Farley. And he had kept him away from all the bad influences. So when Tom Arnold heard that Chris died, he immediately called Chris Farley's parents.
Hmm.
And as far as hate mail goes, it's more of a, we talked about sort of mining, comment mining.
Mm.
And one of the comments on Hollywood Death Trip, which was the show that we did for E, a woman just simply wrote, Hollywood is Satan's propaganda machine. I released about a few weeks ago an interview that I did with Stephen Weiss, who was the little boy that found the gun that was used at the Tate murders. And
no
I,
longer a little boy.
I met him in front of the house where he found the gun, and he met us out there. And it was just something we did on the fly, so it's a terrible recording. But it's fucking good information, you know? It's from the source. And people can't seem to let it go, you know? They're just really nasty about the style of recording. I'm like, you know, whatever. But anyway, the comments were funny. Like, here's a couple. Charlie killed no one. And Tate was not killed. It was a hoax to destroy the hippie movement. And the second one, the Manson murders were fake, old fake. Nobody really got shot. Nobody really got stabbed. Nobody really died. It was a spy op hoax faked like Sandy Hook. And it's a big fat lie.
There's people that think that. I've even when we were making the movie, I came across people that believe that the crime scene photos were faked, and there was this one police officer at the scene who appears in several different press photos, and look, it's the same guy, and it's like, well, yeah, he was there.
I can't go there. Oh my god!
What reality do some people live in? It's kind of wild, but
it's interesting. The Chaos book that came out not that long ago by Tom O'Neill, he made an interesting association that the President Nixon at the time, you know, who was an attorney, made comments during the trial that Manson was guilty before the trial was over with, and so he was using Manson as a pawn to get people to turn against the hippies. But I don't believe it was any kind of conspiracy. It was just something that Nixon did. And what is fascinating to say is that somehow Nixon said that Manson is guilty during the trial before it even went to jury. Mm. And it was the headline of the LA Times the next day, or the LA Daily News: Manson guilty, Nixon declares. And somehow Manson got a copy of it and showed it to the jury during the trial.
What?
And here's the president saying, right, guilty. And they didn't throw the case out, you know, and I think that's crazy.
That is pretty wild.
To be said for government and this case. I don't know if that, you know, I don't like conspiracies. They're too exhausting.
Wild that they didn't think that influenced the jury in any way, though. That's kind of wild.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a sloppy, messy trial.
Yeah.
Now, the interview that I did with Officer Wills, who was the man who gave, you hooked me up with him, actually, the man who gave Manson a ticket that, I forget, was for a burned out light or something like that. Mm-hmm. The day before the murders, Manson said he was out of town, and Officer Wills' citation proved that Manson wasn't.
Right.
And so it sort of blew his alibi. And the comment was, I was there. Manson didn't do it, but his dad, the king, didn't believe him. So he gave his only begotten son, not of the marriage. Read the Bible, you people, will tell me the truth. No, read the Bible, you people will never tell me the truth.
All right.
There you are.
Fair. Fair.
My particular favorite this week, though, and I've got, this is, you might want to just cut this, but somebody, I did, because I'm so bored, I'm putting up my autograph collection and stuff. I'm just going through it and I'm putting them on YouTube, you know, my collections.
Sure.
And people, you know, get to see the junk that I collected. And somebody wrote, this is in the comments, I pretty much just want to masturbate to your voice.
That is high praise.
You know what? I don't get much fan mail, but that one was like, all right.
That's going in the shoebox. And I just wanted to give, we had a positive note that I wanted to highlight because it's very topical. On our Patreon page, which just to remind everybody, we are on Patreon now, which you can join for as little as $2 a month. We got a note from someone named Mandy, and she said, hey guys, I'm an ER nurse who is knee deep in COVID-19, and your podcast/videos are one of the only things that are keeping me sane right now. So thank you. Stay safe. So Mandy, thank you very much for that note. And I think we should just dedicate this show to you and all the other first responders and people working in the hospitals that are dealing with this right now. We're happy to give that kind of entertainment escape. From what's going on right now, you know?
Unthinkable. It is unthinkable what's going on right now. And so much. It's awful, and we're so grateful. And thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mandy. Here we go. Main show, Different Strokes.
It's time for the main feature.
Ran from, as we said earlier, from 1978 to 1986, originally on NBC, and then at the end it switched over to ABC. Always fascinating how that happens. The plot line being simple, two African-American kids from Harlem get adopted by a rich white widowed businessman on Park Avenue. And so it's this fish out of water story with these two black kids played by Gary Coleman and Todd Bridges playing Arnold and Willis. And then the dad is played by Conrad Bain. And then his daughter from his wife that passed away was played by Dana Plato. Her name was her character's name was Kimberly. The show also led to the huge hit spinoff, The Facts of Life. And also was known for making heavy use of very special episodes that sitcoms really did back in the 80s and 90s largely. They would do, they almost would turn for one episode into a drama. They would tackle some serious subject matter like drug use. I do remember there was a double episode of Different Strokes where they got kidnapped. The Golden Girls, I think, did their very special episode, the Hurricane episode. So Different Strokes kind of got known for being, you know, it seemed like every season at least one episode would be like the serious subject matter. And then it was also known for catchphrases from Gary Coleman. His "What you talking about, Willis?" Is one of the more famous catchphrases from the 80s.
He loved that. He loved it. He loved when people came up to him and said that.
"What you talking about, Gary?" I only remember
one. He never got tired of it.
I only remember one other line from the show, and I just remember it was a. I remember Willis is talking to Arnold, and he's telling Arnold that something's gonna happen. He's gonna go to jail for it, and I just remember Gary Coleman goes, "Only bars I want to see are candy bars," and for some reason, I have always remembered that line. So there it is. Your thoughts.
Mike, I never watched the show in my life. It was not my time. I mean,
no.
I'm a kid from the 60s. Mm-hmm. And, it was on. It was around. I was aware of it. You know, I was aware more so of Gary Coleman than anything else because he became such an icon.
Sure.
It was never, none of those shows ever really, you know, I never watched The Golden Girls. I the sitcoms, One Day at a Time, I kind of watched. I liked that and Good Times. And I think those are more early 70s than these guys were. But I was never Norman Lear to me, because it was more of an adult edge to Norman Lear's stuff. And I think that Different Strokes is more kid oriented, you know.
Right.
It was aimed at young kids, like Facts of Life was aimed
exactly
at young kids. And by that time I was done with it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, by the time, you know, Full House came around, I was in like junior high going into high school, so I'd aged out of that, their target audience, you know. So that's probably kind of how Different Strokes, a lot of these other family sitcoms were for you, right?
Yeah. I mean, I became more aware of it because we used to go to, I used to go to autograph shows too. And I, you know, see all those people around. Dana Plato was always there. And so was Gary Coleman and Todd Bridges, you know. So yeah, I was aware of them more as people than I was more of the show, you know.
Did you ever meet any of them?
Yeah, I met them all at different times. Yeah. Not Conrad Bain, but yeah,
the kids.
I did.
So first up to die from the show is probably the most, you know, I guess, infamous of the downfalls of any of the cast members, and that's Dana Plato. Kind of became the poster girl for, child star gone wrong, you know, toward the end of her
life. I mean,
there was
Anissa Jones, there was, you know, Danny Bonaducci, there was,
mm-hmm.
you know,
there's
it seems
bunch.
Like they all perpetuate the... But Dana Plato did it with, you know, with bells on. I mean, she spiraled and we all watched it.
So did you met her at some of these autograph signings?
Yeah, she was one. I mean, I'm not, you know, she was out there. She's probably wasted, you know, and I don't know on what, and I'm not saying that isn't any, you know, she'd take her shirt off or, you know, she was really, you know, not very self-conscious, and you could tell it was sort of probably not motivated by, her
right.
own thoughts,
I got
altered,
you.
Altered thoughts. So, but she was a live wire and she was a hit at those things, but she was really, it was kind of hard to watch. It was.
Yeah. She got married in 1984. I think she was only like 20 and almost immediately got pregnant. And when that happened, that's when they wrote her out of the show. So she wasn't in the last couple of seasons.
I think they sent her to Paris or something like that. Yeah, because they didn't want her to be pregnant on the show.
And she never really, her career never really recovered after that. She tried to, you know, get a career going as an adult, but it was hard, I think, for her to be taken seriously because of the role she played. And then all the, you know, she's just bad publicity after bad publicity doesn't help.
I don't know if she had a problem during the show with substance abuse, but it didn't, it took off pretty quickly afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
And so the choices she was making were, you know, posing nude for Playboy, and
which she did in 89. Yeah.
Yeah. And she just wasn't, you know, she wasn't, I guess, getting the offer she wanted. So she was doing the stuff probably she thought would get her notice. So, and more provocative.
Yeah. And, she started doing softcore porn really in the 90s. Yeah. And one of them was called Different Strokes, The Story of Jack and Jill and Jill.
That classic, yeah.
Who doesn't have that in their collection, right? But there was one really cool thing that she did. I believe it was the first video game to use live action video.
Oh, really?
It was called Night Trap. It was for Sega. It was done in the 90s. I think it made her the first or one of the first celebrities to star in a video game. And the whole thing takes place at a mansion, and she's this part of a group of teenage girls in the mansion, and bad guys are trying to get at them. And your job, there's like a series of security cameras set up in the different rooms of the mansion, and your job is to keep the girls safe and to keep these different intruders from getting at them. It was a really interesting concept. It didn't do that well, but what was really interesting was they filmed the scenes for it in Culver City, and the cinematographer was Don Burgess. Don Burgess, 2 years later, was the cinematographer on Forrest Gump and went on to do some enormous films. He was big with Zemeckis. He did Aquaman most recently. He did Wonder a couple years ago. Like, he's done some really huge films, but he was the cinematographer for this Night Trap video game. And you can actually, if you look online, there's gameplay videos of Night Trap. You can see what you can see her acting in the game. It's kind of interesting.
I mean, I don't know. I forget when that whole slasher genre became big. I know Halloween was like 79, was it? Mm-hmm. Or 78. And but she would have been good at that. You know, mm-hmm. She would have been good, but I think she was just a little too young. You know, by the time she finished with Different Strokes in 84, maybe that genre was already on its way out. But she'd have been really good in one of those Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street movies.
Yeah, it didn't work out. She basically went broke. She claimed, I think, a business manager stole a bunch of her money, and that person was never found. But who knows? I mean, with a drug addiction or drug issues, you know, sometimes stories get made up to make up for, you know, give an excuse for all the money went. So I don't know. Maybe she really was ripped off. I don't know if that's true or not. But she lost custody of her kid that she had from that first marriage in the 80s. She was working minimum wage job. She was living in Vegas for a while. And in 1991, she robbed a video store with a pellet gun. And the guy called 911 and said, "I've just been robbed by the girl who played Kimberly on Different Strokes." He like immediately recognized her. She got $164 and then for some reason came back to the scene, and the police were there and they arrested her. But she got lucky.
Well, so, now, you know why she went back to the scene? As I read in one report, because she left her glasses behind.
Oh, really?
And she went to go pick up her glasses. Now, I mean, because this makes sense, because you're coming up with that she went back. So
right.
I'm saying this is a weird little fact that I wasn't going to say anything. But when you said for some reason, it's like I did read that she went back to get her glasses.
Oh, my God.
Which means she clearly wasn't thinking well. She wasn't thinking clearly.
Yeah. But she got lucky. She got 5 years probation when she could have got, you know, decades for that. And then
the next year, you know, the next year she got 5 more years of probation. I mean, for forging Valium prescriptions. I mean, you know, I mean, that's 5 years probation, and then the next year getting another 5 years probation. It seems kind of, you know, they would have given her a year or two, I would have thought, and maybe that would have cleaned her up.
Right.
But she was she had that that reputation of being a live wire after that, and she was the proverbial child star gone wrong, and she did have the reputation of being you know, a drug addict, and people were selling stories to the tabloids that she was a drug addict.
Yeah.
I mean, she had some really scummy people around her. Reading all, because I've saved articles, I've scanned them in for years, and I have them all on my computer, and thousands of files, and so many people sold stories about her to the tabloids. It's really gross, and it didn't end when she died either. But we'll get into that.
And
that just
becomes a self perpetuating downward spiral. Do you know what I mean? Because those things make her situation worse, make it even harder for her to get back into the film business. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And I guess her reputation was so much so that I guess Howard Stern was mocking her. And so she asked him if she could appear on the show to defend herself. But that turned into a, you know.
And that was the day before she died.
Yeah. And so one of her old roommates called up and said she was a lesbian who was a junkie. And, you know, Dana Plato's just being bombarded. You know, right. She's being hit by and she swears at that point that she had been sober for 10 years. So,
and was like, test me, drug test me right now or something, right? Or something yeah. like that. I can prove yeah. it. Yeah.
So, yeah, unfortunately.
And the next day, her and her, I think it was her husband at the time, were driving back.
Boyfriend.
What's that? Was a boyfriend?
Yeah. A fiance. He says he was her fiance.
Right. And, so they drive to Moore, Oklahoma, which is outside Oklahoma City. They visit his mother, I believe, and she overdosed in a mobile home or a trailer on the property, yeah. right?
Yeah. Somebody reached out to me about a year ago and asked if I was interested in buying the home, the motor home, no. and sent me pictures of it and everything. It's
holy
like,
holy cow, somebody you know, kept that.
Yeah, they still have it. I mean, I would consider it because it's such a curiosity. Maybe I'll take my little museum on the road. I don't know, but it's a curiosity. It's sort of right up my alley.
You could have the Dana Plato. You could have the Dana Plato mobile home towing the Jane Mansfield death car just from down
Wouldn't that
to
be
town,
something?
Right?
Wouldn't that be something? We're not mocking. We're not mocking. But so what now? What's so bizarre about her overdose is that at the scene, it's confusing to me, and I was trying to put the facts all together, but there was a guy that she was on the phone with who was representing her on some way, and he was talking to her, and then she went to lay down or something, and this guy was selling it. And you could find it. There's like a 5-minute clip of it on YouTube, and you can hear this exhale in the background. Now, I don't know, but whether that's been enhanced or something. This was also, you know, a long time ago, so it was before they really anyone could do that on their computer. In fact, people didn't have computers back then. It wasn't that kind of a generation yet. So, but yeah, I communicated with the guy briefly when I was still living over in the UK. And I told him, I mean, it's a curiosity. It's really a nasty thing to do. And if it was a family member of mine, you know, I'd probably do something awful or yeah. think about doing something awful. However, historically, you know, as a show business personality as she was, it's still a fascinating document. As yeah. shitty as it is, it is still history, and it's still fascinating. It's like looking at crime scene photos in a way. And it's just sad. But this guy who was her fiance at the time, he was sued by Dana Plato's son for wrongful death because they think that he could have done something to save her. But he did. The son did ultimately sue the kid. But I mean, there was all sorts of bottom feeders. There always is.
Yeah.
But so blatant, so, you know, just not even trying to be, you know, secretive or
yeah.
you know, it just like pouncing, like I don't know, it's gross. It's gross. And I know that's some people would say that's hypocritical of me, but, I, you know, and fair enough, because it's a weird line. But then I would have bought them, you know. That's what sucks. I mean, like Frank Gorshin's underwear that I wanted to buy. You know what I mean? It's fascinating. It's different when people die tragically. I'm not going to say that, but it's, you know, it's a fascinating thing. It's history. It's my artifact, and you know, it's just a weird blurry line.
So Moore, Oklahoma, where she died. This is a weird coincidence. Most recently, probably well known to the world because of the horrible tornado that hit in 2013, I think killed like 10 people there. But Moore, Oklahoma, of all the places, she passed away there. Danny Cooksey, the actor that played Sam, the little boy that joined the cast toward the end of the run, he was a little redheaded kid. He was born in Moore, Oklahoma.
So oh, weird.
Dana Plato died in the hometown of one of the actors from the show.
That's very strange. Mm-hmm. What a weird coincidence.
Yeah.
So Dana Plato's funeral was at the Will Geer Theatricum Botanicum in Topanga Canyon. Will Geer was famously played the grandfather on the Waltons. Was a has an amphitheater in Topanga Canyon with his name, and also that's where his ashes are. And it's beautiful outdoor little. You know, it's really nice. It's really nice. And, you know, weirdly, who runs it is his daughter, Ellen Geer. And Ellen Geer was one of the girls in Harold and Maude who was that he was set up on a date with. But anyway, that's where her memorial service was held. And then, according to what I read, Tyler, and who's the son, and her ex-husband, his father, scattered her ashes over the Pacific Ocean. And but when, you know, when she died, Gary Coleman said, it's very unfortunate that Dano is no longer with us. She was a wonderful woman, but her death was a welcome, though sad, piece of closure to Different Strokes. The possibility of a reunion no longer exists now, and thank God.
How freaking weird.
That's Gary Coleman. Wow. You know, that's he is something else, man. He was something else. He was
wild. Is that Dana?
Well, the sad note on this, or the saddest note, I think, what tops it off is that 11 years after Dana Plato died, her son committed suicide.
Yeah.
He was 25 years old. Yeah. It was almost 11 years to the day after Dana Plato's death that he killed himself. So just God, what a messed up set of circumstances.
And what's wild is Gary Coleman died almost 11 years to the day. 11 years and 20 days difference.
Was it?
Yeah. May 28, 2010 was Gary Coleman. And Dana died on May 8th, 1999 at 34. That's crazy. Conrad Bain?
Well, you know, Conrad Bain, there's nothing about the guy that's negative. You know, he was never anything but classy about anybody on the show. You know, he expressed empathy. He said it breaks his heart what happened to these kids. And, weirdly, he had a twin brother. He had an identical twin brother. When Conrad Bain, I knew him from Maude beforehand with B. Arthur and, and he was the next-door neighbor married to Rue McClanahan, who ended up being the Golden Girl.
Right.
But anyway, Conrad Bain, I guess, and on the show, Maude had a twin brother, and he showed up actually on the show, which is just sort of a curiosity. But he was a, Todd Bridges called him being a positive and supportive father figure, both on screen and off. And he said that Conrad Bain made going to work each day more enjoyable for all of them. And Conrad Bain died of a stroke on January 14th, 2013, in a retirement home in Livermore, California.
Wow.
Livermore. Never heard of it.
So if you thought that Dana Plato's biography was a roller coaster, buckle up.
Yeah.
Gary Coleman was like a whole other level.
Yeah, he really was. God, he was born with a chip on his shoulder.
Yep.
Unfortunately, you know, he was born, disabled physically. You know, he was born with a congenital kidney disease during his life. He had, you know, chronic renal failure, staph infection, heart valve surgery, 2 kidney transplants. You know,
yep.
so he had a really, really rough life. I forget how tall he was.
He was He was 4'8", and it was stunted by a combination of the kidney problems and the medication he had to take for the treatment for the kidney problems resulted in stunting his growth. So he stopped growing at 4'8".
No wonder he was bitter. I mean, my God, you know, and also to be chronically treated like a child because you're of that size or stature, he didn't take things lightly, you know. He was pretty miserable, and his physical maladies, I guess, didn't. I mean, and he was shit on, God, you know, by his parents and by everyone around him, and his last wife. But we're gonna get into all that.
So he sued his parents in 1989, and his business advisor. He claimed that they mismanaged his finances, which is crazy, just like Jackie Coogan. You know, a generation or two before. And he ended up 4 years later winning a $1.28 million judgment. But apparently that was still just like, you know, a fraction of what he would have made throughout the course of his career at that point, you know?
I mean, at that, you know, when he started, my friend Mark Mark Masick, who wrote a book called Hollywood Remains to Be Seen, he did a lot of research on Gary Coleman. And he said when he started, when Coleman started shooting the series, he was making $1,500
an episode.
And ultimately went up to $30,000 an episode. And Conrad Bain was making, you know, $25,000. Todd Bridges, $15,000. At the end of it, he was actually making $80,000 an episode.
Gary Coleman was?
So, yes, he was. I mean, he was worth a ton of money. And also, when the show ended, he said Mark figured this out, and he had to, in his total of that show, he made more than $7 million, and he received an additional $1 million a year when the series went into syndication. So he should have been living high on the hog.
Plus, then, there was all the other. He was doing other things. He was in other movies and TV shows and other. He was getting paid for other stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And
he
had been a commercial actor, which is how he got cast. He did some kind of high profile commercials, and that's how he got on the show. Basically, they decided to make a show around him. So yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, he was an industry. He was, and he now the way this worked out. And forgive me, I don't want to. If you're cool, I'm just going to continue on. So
yeah,
the way
ahead.
Mark figured this out, so he was making these huge paychecks, and Mark figured out, he says, Coleman's parents set up a trust fund as required by law, but they also set themselves up as paid employees receiving 20% of the son's income. Lawyers and accountants and publicists and agents. The group invested a large chunk of his money in a Beverly Hills business that went bankrupt. When Coleman turned 18 and the trust was dissolved, he discovered there was less than $1 million in the account, $220,000 for Coleman and $770,000 for his parents.
He had enough money at the end for basically 2.5 episodes of what he was getting paid at the end of that run, basically, is how much he got left with. That's crazy.
I don't know if he was part of the... I'm not sure when that whole syndication thing really took off. I mean, we know what happened to the Gilligan's Island, and those guys got paid for 2 reruns. I would have thought things got a bit better at that point. But it said $1 million a year that he was supposed to get.
That
is
interesting. When did that start? Because I know, you know, when Friends went off the air, that was the syndication for them was huge. Because I think they said
making $1 million an episode at that point.
Yeah, I think they said each of the Friends main cast had made about $80 million throughout the life of Friends. And then in syndication, they stood to make another $80 million each off of that. So I do, like you said, I wonder at what point between the horrible deals they got in the 60s and 70s and what the Friends got, you know, a couple decades later, when in there did the deals get better for the actors?
Better agents, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
After that, he became sort of a novelty. You know, nobody could take him seriously after that because of his size and because of his... It became well known, his antics. You know, he couldn't get work because he had a terrible personality.
And he was Arnold from... From Different Strokes. Actually, how do you get it? And he's not going to be, he's 4'8". He's Arnold. He's that little kid from Different Strokes for the rest of his life. He's always going to look like younger than smaller than he is. It really is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And people would go up to him and like want to pick him up and stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And understandably, he goes, don't pick me up. You know, do not touch me.
Don't rub my head.
You know, there's a way that people nowadays have been trained or I don't know. He had all the cards stacked against him. You know,
well, and he ended up getting an assault charge because some female fan wanted a picture with him or an autograph, and he was like, no. And then it started into this verbal altercation, and then he ended up, I think, hitting her, and he got an assault charge out of it, and it's just like, a poor guy.
Yeah. He was, nobody really took him seriously. And that's right. She wanted an autograph. He was working as a security guard at that point.
I remember that.
And he was wearing a name tag. It was for a Diane Keaton movie, I guess. And he was wearing a name tag that said Wayne. He said, because sometimes people call me Wayne.
People are going to not recognize him.
Yeah. According to the report, she asked for an autograph. she asked for a person. I guess he signed it for her. Then she asked for personalization, and he refused. She said to him, "That's why you're a child star and not an adult one." And the police officer said that he leapt up and started pummeling her. And when he had to leap up, she laughed at him, which made him even more furious. But I can see that happening. I can see him be angry enough to do something like that, because there's lots of footage of him being an angry guy. He's one of the people that ran for governor in 2003.
He came in eighth place.
You know, Larry Flint and Angeline and the comedian Gallagher and Gary Coleman. That was a joke. And then Schwarzenegger won, which was another joke. And there, I said it. And so it's just so, whatever, man. I'm not going to say whatever. That sounds dismissive of him. But it was one thing after the other. Did you ever hear the recording of him doing phone sex?
Thankfully, no.
It exists. Exists. And it's like, imagine my tiny body crawling all over you.
I think I did see something. Read this transcript or something. Yeah.
Oh, I have the audio. It's something. It was something else. But he was what they call a foamer. And you know, foamers are people that are into trains.
Yeah, he was into model trains. It supposedly came because he used to take the real train stuff. Yeah, well, he used to take the train a lot as a kid, going, you know, when he was getting his career going. So he fell in love with real trains, and then he got into model training. Neil Young is also a model train enthusiast.
Have you ever watched videos on YouTube of foamers? And there's this guy that there's a train pulling in, there's a vintage train pulling in, and this guy's just videotaping it, and this guy's losing his shit. He's like, oh that guy is so beautiful. I mean, it's like he finished his own work without even touching himself. It's fascinating. Somebody anonymously sent me an email, said that this is somebody I knew, somebody I know that sent this, said that a buddy of mine, a sheriff, busted Gary Coleman jerking off at some train tracks.
Wow.
That's because he was into that. Foamers are, you know, it's like train spotters in a weird way, except I don't know if train spotters find a sexual charge from it. But Gary Coleman was way into it.
Wow. You didn't see this because you didn't watch the show. There was a crossover episode of Different Strokes with Knight Rider. And really? You have to understand that when this happened, Knight Rider was my other favorite show. And they did a crossover. The episode was called Hooray for Hollywood. It was a two-parter because there was a cliffhanger in the end of the first episode. It was called Hooray for Hollywood, and Arnold and, you know, Gary Coleman and his best friend on the show, they visit the Knight Rider set while they're filming.
So it was like a third wall thing or whatever.
Yeah,
you call
so
that.
David Hasselhoff is playing himself. David Hasselhoff is in the show, and it looks like it was shot on the Universal Studios lot there. And they Gary Coleman and his friend crawl into this police car and are hiding in the back seat, and they don't realize the car is going to be blown up in this scene. And so at the last second, you know, they do the to be continued. And then at the beginning of the next episode, they pick right up where they left off. And at the last second, Hasselhoff sees their faces in the back seat and stops the guy from blowing the car up, and he saves them. And it's this whole like thing. But yeah, it was awesome. And then he did a made for TV movie in 1980 called Scout's Honor.
Gary Coleman did?
Yep. He played a Cub Scout. I'll just say it was a made-for-TV movie in 1980. That pretty much describes it. But they get, I think, I don't remember, I remember the beginning, but I guess I read up on it again, and the plot was that they go into a cave, and there's a cave-in, and they got to get out of there, and their troop master is this lady who doesn't like little kids, and she learns to like little kids. So how you could learn to like little kids by being trapped with them in a cave, I don't quite follow that logic. But it was called Scout's Honor, and I'm sure you can find it on the internet because the internet has.
I'll look for it.
Everything.
He was a, you know, as a person, he was. I mean, not only was he a miserable person, but he was really pervy too. I was watching an interview with the cast on Sinbad's show when he had a talk show, and Dana Plato talks about. She says, just don't get stuck in an elevator with Gary because he's all over you. As soon as the door is shut, he's like, you know, he's all over you, touching your and
wow.
What prompted me looking that up was that there's something that you got to see. It's Molly Shannon on Conan, and she tells a story about when she first came to Hollywood, and she has a meeting with an agent, and she thinks it's Gary Coleman's agent, and she thinks, this is it, I have arrived. and the agent says, well, let's have dinner with Gary, and Gary, you know, is getting kind of handsy with her, and then says, come on up to my room, and just pounces on top of her, and she's like kicking him off, and she runs into the bathroom. She's telling it funny. I mean, right. She's because everyone's dying because, you know, Gary Coleman's like, I like you, I like you. And he's like, and she runs into the bathroom and she says, and he's looking under the door saying, I can see you. Come on out. Come on out. Is really something to watch. But Molly Shannon, it's very a very Me Too thing. And maybe you would find it, people wouldn't like it nowadays. But
it hasn't aged. Yeah, it hasn't, like Gary Coleman, it hasn't
Molly
aged.
Molly Shannon is so funny. And it just. Too many people say too many, you know, the same thing. There's some legitimacy to that. But Gary Coleman, you know, weirdly, because when you're the star like that, and he was a huge star at that point, you know, you're kind of feel like you can get away with anything.
Yeah.
And so
and you wonder how many times he did that and it worked. How many times he did that and the girl was into it. Who knows? Do you know what I mean? And who or how many other horror stories young actresses have of being in that situation with him that didn't become famous, so we never heard the story. Yeah,
it's like, I mean, being with Gary Coleman would be a curiosity. And if you saw the movie, did you see Midgets and Mascots?
Oh, I missed that one.
Oh my God,
what is it?
It's up there with Jackass. It's so fucking funny. And in a way that's totally toilet humor. But there's a point where Gary Coleman is in a bathhouse in a sauna or something like that, and there becomes this confrontation. And Gary Coleman's playing a dicky Gary Coleman in it, and you wonder if he's acting it or not.
Right.
And it's really good. I promise you, it's up like Jackass. It's so funny. But there's a point where his robe falls open, and he's like got like a horse dick. I mean, literally. A horse dick. And it's only for a half a second. Of course, I'm like, you know, I'm like, I got the screen captures and it was like, you know, it was like, oh my God, this had to be fake. But it was well done because the movie was so tongue in cheek and you didn't know if he was acting or not. And please watch it. And the Molly Shannon clip. They're both very, very funny.
Awesome.
Are you on email right now?
Yeah. Are you going to send me this?
I've got to.
You're going to get my reaction my to browser. It live. Is that his arm? That can't be. Damn. All right.
I mean, it had to be fake. It had to be fake, but it was like.
You would think. Wow. You would think, right? Because that was. I'm sure that was planned. All right. Well, hey, you know what, man? Gary Coleman.
I was back in the... When I first moved back to L.A. and I was working for another one of the tour companies, I did an episode of the Ryan Seacrest show where he took a Hollywood tour. And we had, you know, a bus full of tourists, and Ryan Seacrest gets on the bus, and I'm taking him all through Beverly Hills and went to the Osbournes' house and stuff like that. So we pull up to a limousine, and Ryan Seacrest is saying, you know, there's never any stars in limousines. It's always kids going to prom or something like that. Of course, this is all set up, you know. But
right.
So Ryan Seacrest gets out of the bus and knocks on the window, and a door opens, and it's Gary Coleman. So Gary Coleman gets out of the limo and gets on my tour bus. And I don't know, he's got a cold or something. He's got a nasty cold. And he's got this shitty piece of rolled up Kleenex in his hand. And he's trying to talk to people. And he just hands me the Kleenex like I'm going to take it. You know, I'm like, here's my shitty, snotty Kleenex. And I'm going to touch that shit. And that's why I did say that because it was so gross. And I was shocked that he did it. But
did you save it?
No, I wasn't going to touch that shit. It's gross. So, but it would be something I would do. I mean, I've saved celebrity cigarette butts and things like that, too. But Gary Coleman's snotty Kleenex, even I do have a line, and that would have definitely crossed it. But it was funny because he was he hopped on the bus, and we drove around. We went over to Rodeo Drive, and he's talking to everybody. And, of course, they're, you know, really enamored because these are people from other countries and other states that aren't around celebrities. So, and he was eating it up. I mean, they were loving him, and he was loving it. The one thing I kept noticing is that he commonly referenced being famous. You know, he was saying it a lot. He goes, now you're going to be famous. But it was an interesting experience that, again, only in L.A., you know. One day I end up on Ryan Seacrest's show. There you are. But, yeah.
So he met a woman that he ended up marrying on, I think she was an extra on a movie that he was in 2007. And it seems like they got married, like, pretty much right away. And then it was a bad idea. It was a bad marriage. It didn't work out. And within, like, a year or so, they were divorced. But then
divorce court.
Yeah, and they were on. Yes, right. They went on the TV show.
It was so gross.
And then she was like 24 or something like that, I think. But then she kept living with him in his house.
Yeah, they split up for like a year, and then they got back together. And yeah, they moved in together. She moved into his house in Utah, I guess, where they were living.
Yeah,
and so they were still technically under the same roof. They were together, but theirs was a you know, a volatile relationship. I mean, that mugshot came from an issue that the two of them had. They had a really rough relationship, and some people, a lot of people have a lot of opinions about it. It makes this next part very interesting. That when it happened, when you know they were together at the home, I think it was May 26th of 2010. And he went downstairs. They were watching TV, according to some sources, watching television. And she heard him fall down the stairs. She heard a clunk or a thunk or something like that. So she went down and found Coleman on the floor in a pool of blood on the back of his head. And she made the 911 call. Now, have you listened to that call?
I have. Yeah. She said it was gross. It was all gross. Yeah.
I just can't be here with the blood. I'm gagging. I have blood on myself. I can't deal.
And then I think she tells him to, you know, put pressure on his head because he was holding the rag or whatever to keep the, because he sat up at one point. And then he ended up in the hospital from that. And
well, he walked out of the house. He did walk out of the house.
And then he died 2 days later on May 28th, 2010. He was only 42. And the cause of death was a subdural hematoma.
Right.
And then there was the deathbed photo.
Yeah.
The Globe.
So the wife, now Shannon, who was not his wife, common law wife, I guess. I'm not sure how that all worked out.
What happened was she claimed after the fact that she was common law because she claimed the estate. And I believe she did have power of attorney over his medical decisions and was handling that. But then after he passed away, you know, she wanted the estate. And the courts ended up ruling that she did not qualify, what their relationship was at that point, did not qualify as common law. Even though they were living under the same roof, it wasn't a real relationship anymore.
Right.
The estate ended up going to a friend of his who I think was also his manager.
Right.
The Globe published a photo of her posing. It was almost like a selfie, right, with him just not long before he died in the hospital bed, and he's got all the tubes and stuff coming out of him. And interesting, you know, she never admitted that she was the one that sold it, but at the same time, I don't know how much she really ever denied it either, and who else would have done it, but whatever. But the Globe published it and wouldn't reveal, you know, who it was that had sold it to them. But
Anna Gray was his assistant or represented him. She ran his corporation. She was named the executrix of his estate. And according to a codicil that he, Gary Coleman, had in his will. And Shannon did sue for half, but Anna, for half of his remains. Actually, when he was cremated, there was a fight over his remains. And Shannon wanted some of his remains to wear around her neck or something like that. Yeah. But Anna, his old assistant, said that, you know, she won the fight and she wouldn't let Shannon have any of the remains. And apparently, according to Anna, she said she wanted to honor his wishes and spread some of his ashes on the Golden Spikes, the historic Utah location where the first transcontinental rail line was completed in 1889.
That's interesting, because he was a train guy. Mm.
Right. Foamer. I don't know where the word foamer comes in.
Yeah,
why that
foamer was, is a weird one, right?
Yeah. So, I don't know. Is that Gary Coleman? I mean, there's all a bunch of bottom feeders around these poor people, you know?
Yeah.
And here we are exploiting them on our podcast.
yeah, those other people. Charlotte Ray.
She was Mrs. Garrett, who started on the first season or maybe two of Different Strokes.
It was like one and a half seasons or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and she was a red-haired sort of housekeeper. And Charlotte Ray was in a billion different things. I mean, she was a staple on 60s television. Car 54, Where Are You? She was a regular on that. And she ended up in so many TV shows. And also, what her first movie was one called Hello Down There. And if you get a chance, this is like encapsulates literally the 60s, because it's a group of kids that are in a rock band and their father invents an underwater house and they have to stay down underwater for like 30 days for this house to get the green light to be manufactured. It's Richard Dreyfuss, one of his first movies, actually. He's in this band and he's staying there. Janet Leigh and Tony Randall. And they play this rock band that live at the bottom of the ocean, and she's the housekeeper who was smuggling the tapes to Roddy McDowell, who's the big record producer. It's a great movie, but Charlotte Ray, I loved her. And I talked to her about that because she did a show. She was in the 80s when I lived in Chicago. She was in a show called Driving Miss Daisy, a play. And someone who was a friend of mine at that point was her personal assistant during the entire run of the show, which was three months or something like that. And she was, I mean, she is just the way you'd think her to be. She was this dotty lady, extremely high maintenance, like a whirlwind when she walked into the room. And I remember my friend was telling me they go shopping and she'd go for the broccoli and snap off all the stems. Just crazy weird stuff. It's very high maintenance, very, very that way. But I did get a chance to talk to her briefly about Hello Down There, which is one of my favorite movies. And she was very nice. And seeing her play a serious role as Miss Daisy was fascinating. Mm. But she was well rounded as a performer, most certainly.
She passed away on August 5th, 2018. She was 92 years old. And, you know, Todd Bridges, who was the last surviving member of the original main cast, he said when she died, "When I hung up the phone, I just broke down. That's hard to deal with. It's really sad and emotional. I had one piece left from that show." So he has no other main cast members from those first seasons that he can talk with about those experiences. He's the last one left.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not like he's an old man, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of wild that he's the last one left, and he's not much older than I am, probably.
There was a woman named Melanie Watson. She played Arnold's friend Kathy Gordon. She died of heart failure at 27. She was young. Ugh. They say that contributed to the curse of Different Strokes. And there was a Brandon Tartikoff. He died. He was, you know, he was 18, Fresh Prince, Cosby Show, Cheers, Golden Girls, and Different Strokes. He died at the age of 48, died young in 97. This guy named Cox, James Cox, wrote me. And this story was good, and I looked it up, and it's all true. James Cox, according to this guy James Cox, who, shout out to you, thanks for the information. He said he worked in Hollywood for over 30 years on TV shows, there's a story you might be interested in. One of the shows I worked on was Mama's Family for two seasons. Now, one of the creators was a man named Dick Clare, who had been a writer for Carol Burnett, but he also was one of the creators of Facts of Life as well, which does lead into this story. So Dick Clare was an active member of the Cryonics Society of California in the 60s. Mm. And in 1982, he contributed $20,000 to the Cryonics organization and to be cryopreserved in liquid nitrogen. Right. So in 1986, he was diagnosed with AIDS, and he was hospitalized. And in 1988, he wanted his head frozen. And the hospital, there was a fight over it because the hospital wasn't going to do it. And there was actually a lawsuit. And he went by the name as John Roe. So the lawsuit was Roe v. Mitchell. And it ended up where he won the lawsuit. And he established a legal right of people to be cryonically preserved in California. So so his head is preserved in Pasadena. And I guess it was a sort of an interesting, because he was supposed to be getting all kinds of royalties from the show since he was a creator, but all of his royalties are going to keep his head frozen in Pasadena. And his family are like, hang on, we're the, you know.
Right, of course.
Or is it so, but yeah, they're going to his head. Quite literally.
I thought his family, we can put him in a freezer for like a few bucks a year, like.
Cryonics fascinate me. They really do. You ever seen you ever seen that that movie called Walt Disney's Head?
Yeah.
Where they it's like, I love that. I love that. That's a it's a great story and it's a funny movie. I like that movie. And he's not. But I think we talked about him in a past episode.
Yeah, we've talked about the urban legend about Disney's frozen head and they've all denied it and it's not true and
I think we're done here. Like Judge Judy said, we are done here. We are done. But what if I know?
All right. Is
go
that,
away. Is oh, that oh, did you see the video that I posted the other day of Angie Dickinson?
No. Oh, when she was on the This Is Your Life or whatever it is.
Oh, it's brilliant. If you haven't seen it yet, you got to see this.
I'll have to check it out.
It's a Pat Sajak. They're on a set. She's supposed to be doing an interview about Brian De Palma. And Pat Sajak shows up and they're just talking. And he says, and Angie Dickinson, this is your life. And she's like, I'm not doing this fucking show. And she's dead serious. She goes, everyone that knows me knows I will never do this show. And she walked off, basically. Yeah.
That happened with James Gandolfini in Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, the original series. Do you ever hear about that?
Were they going to hijack him?
I think some of the show's producers set it up and just didn't realize he was not going to do it because it was when he was still doing The Sopranos and they showed up and he had a freaking meltdown, like a fit. Like he's like, hell no, I'm not going to be on this show. And he wouldn't do it. And that was
the end. That's hijacking. That's Angie Dickinson. This is subterfuge.
It kind of amazes me that with a major star, you would do anything without running it by them ahead of time. That's pretty crazy.
And then, Angie's like assistant is behind her with a big smile on her face. And then, they all end up where they have to, the audience is there and everything. And they have to go out and explain to the audience that she left and the whole while she's mic'd, even when the screen goes dark. So she's like, but Angie, what if we, she's like, if you listen to the, I will not do this show. And it's fascinating. She's classy about it, classy enough to be, to have, but everyone who knows her knows she'll never talk about the stuff people want to talk about.
Right. Wow.
Anyway, we are done.
We did it. All right. So thanks again to our Patreon supporters and all of our listeners everywhere and our Facebook followers and everybody. We're going to keep trying to do this, every couple weeks if we can. And,
bonus episode will be ready soon for our Patreons. I mean, these episodes are always going to be free, but we do have the bonus one because we're trying to eke out a living and my career's in the toilet. So your patronage is very much appreciated. And that bonus episode will be everyone. This stuff will still be free for everyone, but there will be a little bonus to make it sweet for people that do support us.
Cool. All right, guys. Everybody, I hate this. It's a cliche thing to say, but everybody stay safe and stay healthy. And we will see you on the next one.
Wash your hands.
Wash your hands.
20 seconds. Doesn't matter if it's cold water. Wash your hands.
Right.
Foamy soap. That's important. Foamy soap.
The foam is what kills it.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. Later, guys.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.